Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 105 featuring Justin Vanderlick, who is from the Netherlands and an amazing and wonderful, wonderful person. I knew him back at Digital Domain. He is a really, really great artist. He started off doing integration and sort of moved into the environments team and did some Nuke environments work, which is a 3D projections and matte painting. Really, really amazing story. He has an incredible backstory, just like you, Sean.
Thank you.
So I'm not going to spoil it because I actually want you to hear a little bit about what he did to get into the visual effects world, because he was very persistent, which is something that I think is really great. The other thing is, you know, obviously he's been around the world. He worked at Weta, he worked at ILM, he worked at DD, and he worked on Star Wars The Force Awakens. I know you like that movie, right?
I love The Force Awakens.
You love The Force Awakens. So all of the... What's the name of the planet, the desert planet?
Jakku.
So he did all the Jakku environments work. The big ships that are crashed in there. And then, of course, the Millennium Falcon
takeoff
and the fight and all that stuff.
Cool.
So
Wow.
Yeah. So all of the environment work, that was all done by him and his team. Well, he was the leader of that team. Oh. And he worked on The Hobbit as well. So that's another big thing for him. So very, very great guy. Really like him. So, but let's see. We've got a couple of announcements. I'm going to first talk about Project Felix.
It's huge.
Huge. So Project Felix is from Adobe.
Mm-hmm.
And it is part of Adobe. It's in beta now. It's a completely new product. So if you happen to have the Adobe Creative Cloud, you can just try it out. It's in beta. But basically, it's Adobe's first attempt at a 3D application, and the rendering engine inside of it is actually V-Ray. Believe it or not. So they license V-Ray from us and use it in a very special way, which is really very simple. It's essentially just like, do you want it high quality or low quality? Or do you want to make it big? You want to render it on the cloud? And that's about the only kind of options you have. But they make it really sort of geared towards the graphic designer. Yeah. So it's really cool. Lots of news on that. We have a bunch of links on social networks about this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we have a couple different links. There's an FX Guide article about it.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Who else?
CG Channel, I think. Art of 3D Artists.
3D Artists.
3D
right.
Artists, sorry.
Yes, 3D Ooh. Artists. And what was something other thing? There's some event that's happening. There's some competition, right, Sean?
Oh, yeah. The ASAI, American Society of Architectural Illustrators.
Yeah.
They're doing their Architecture in Perspective 32 competition.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big cash prize, $5,000 cash prize.
Nice.
The deadline is coming up really fast, February 3rd. So you can submit your work to them. They're taking renderings and sketches and everything. There is a link on our Twitter if you want to look at it there, or I think you can just go to their homepage.
ASAI.org or something?
Yeah.
Okay, so just look up ASAI. I'm sure you'll find it on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Google it. All right. Well, that's it from rainy Los Angeles.
I know.
We've had so much rain this week. It's been incredible. But I hope you enjoyed the podcast with Justin. It was a blast having him here. All right, thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Awesome, we're in good shape. Cool. I didn't want to spoil anything. I didn't want to talk to you too much because I didn't want to get anything, any cool, exciting stories. So, all right. So you've got a newborn girl.
Yes, yes. 8 weeks old now.
8 weeks old.
Yeah, and it's a trip. It's amazing. It's really, really cool.
What is her name?
Her name is Jaya, like Princess Leia, except with a J.
Jaya,
so,
okay.
A little bit of nerddom already in there, so she's set up for life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's amazing. She's been super sweet. She's been sleeping. You know, she's been a dream. So I guess we kind of lucked out.
Yeah, I have two kids. Mine are 10 and 7. A lot of people already know that, but
I remember that. Like you brought her into DD and I remember in the early days, like, she was running around, because you have a daughter and...
I have a son, too, yeah.
Yeah, and I think your daughter was actually drawing, like, R2-D2 and C-3PO, and was like, that is some baller stuff, man. You got your kids drawing that stuff?
Yeah. Well, so she was excited about it because she, I mean, obviously, she didn't really have a choice. She was going to watch Star Wars at a very young age. So to her, she was like, yay, this is great. And she knew all the characters. And she also could see, just walking around DD,
yep,
there's a bunch of people out there that kind of like the same kind of stuff.
Exactly.
And so she drew pictures for everyone. And she's very social.
Yeah.
So she was like going around giving the pictures to people. And I think there are people bragging about what, like, I got Yoda. What did you get?
It's a little trophy, man. Yeah, I was jealous, man. I never got one.
No. You never did?
No.
Oh, I feel bad about that. Yeah. I feel bad about that. It's funny because I told her that, it was interesting. I told her that you and I were messaging, et cetera, and you were telling me that story. And I went to my daughter, Ellie's like, do you remember doing that? She goes, no, I don't. And I was like, wow. So I guess she must have been like 4 or 5 at the time.
She was really young. Yeah.
She was really young. So, she says, I don't remember drawing for people and giving them on a desk. Like, yeah, you did that. That's cool. But you have been drawing stuff for a long time, right?
Yeah. No, I've been basically fascinated with visual effects since I was, very, very young. Like, uh-huh. I come originally from the Netherlands, from a small town called Nieuwegein.
Yeah.
It's really, really Dutch. And, and my grandma, actually, because, I spend most of my time with my grandma. My grandma was a huge movie fan. She had, like, all these VHS tapes, and she was very modern and contemporary. She loved kung fu movies for some weird reason. She loved...
Really? Your grandma loved kung fu?
Yeah, man. That's it was awesome. Yeah.
Wow.
But the other thing was, too, is that she had a copy around of Star Wars, obviously. So that's how that first connection came.
Yeah.
But she also was a very, very big Disney fan. So she had all the VHSs. And from a very young age, I was just exposed to that and just loved it. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do. But unfortunately, in the Netherlands, like, there's no real film industry, and visual effects and animation didn't really exist back then.
Right.
So, but still, it was a dream. And that's how I kind of started as far as, like, my passion for visual effects.
From your grandmother?
Yeah.
And so she was, she lived nearby, and you just go hang at her house,
yep,
and watch movies?
Yep, that's exactly what I did. Like, she basically lived like two blocks down.
Right.
And it was on the way to school. So in the morning, I would actually have breakfast at grandma's. She would make me breakfast because mom was already went to work, and hang out with her. And, she popped in a VHS tape. We watched together a little bit. And then for lunch, I would come home as well, or to my grandma's.
Right.
And do that all again and basically stay there until my mom would pick me up from work. So.
Wow. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. VHS, I guess, was a big deal back then, right?
Yep,
it was like the whole collection, the big cupboard is like looking at a library of movies, right?
Yeah.
So they don't exist that much anymore in the streaming world. It's just it's on demand, whatever you want.
And it's funny too, because she always said to me, like, when I die, you'll get all these VHS tapes. And then she died when DVDs were over the year. And I was like, fuck. Like, I got I got to take it. So I still have them all, which is
really
pretty awesome. It's really, it's kind of like,
do you have a VHS player?
I don't actually, but we still have them all back home in the Netherlands, and we don't want to part with them because they're very special to us.
Of course. And actually, I think VHS will actually maintain its integrity for a while.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. So how did you said there's an interesting story about how you figured out how to get into visual effects, how to go, because you said there was not much in the Netherlands.
No, it was very, very interesting because it was a frustrating thing because I always wanted to do visual effects. And I was like, how do they do that? And we had one American bookstore in Amsterdam, which is about, an hour by train from where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do when I was a little bit older, I would just go to that American bookstore and, look at all the making of books that were available. And I guess I was, how old was I? Like 12, 13? Like, still very young.
Okay.
And they had the Cinefex. So I got my hands on the first Cinefex, which for me was the one, I guess it was the Hollow Man one from Paul Verhoeven, which was a Dutch director. So I was like, this is very cool. And I asked the American bookstore if they could call me up whenever there was a new Cinefex out. And basically, I would go all the way to Amsterdam and pick it up. And from that point, I basically started reading it and see like who the players were, like ILM and Digital Domain. And mm-hmm. I got very, very excited about it, but it was a tough thing because visual effects just didn't exist. There was no school for that. So I just did regular high school and decided that I might need to do something that was kind of related to it, like the graphic arts. Mm-hmm. So I went to graphic design college.
Okay.
And basically did that more or less. And my other passion that I had, this is a very unrelated thing, but I love dancing. Okay. So from a very young age, I started dancing and the hip hop dancing, break dancing, and I had my own dance group called Illusionary Rockers, and wow. We would go everywhere and like battle people, and it was very cool. But at a certain point, that became serious and it became a profession. So
you were a professional breakdancer?
I was a professional breakdancer. Yeah, dude. Really? It's crazy to think about it. I mean,
really?
I'm glad this is a podcast and not a visual thing, because if you see my gut right now, you wouldn't think.
That's awesome.
And as a side, you know who's actually a really good dancer?
Who's that?
Dan Thrawn.
Really?
Yeah, Dan Thrawn and I busted some moves, man.
Dude, really?
We did. That dude, there's nothing that dude can't do, man. Like, he's an amazing cat, but it's crazy. But yeah, with the whole dancing thing, it basically was another thing that really got connected with it, because if you like dancing, you obviously have to like Michael Jackson.
Sure.
And his music videos were amazing. They had visual effects in them, special effects. And again, that became kind of like a connection to me of like, okay, I gotta really go for this visual effects thing. Mm-hmm. And what was nice about it is that I didn't have a paper route to pay for school. I had my dancing to pay for school. So
sure.
That's how I basically went all the way through graphic design college, which was a really frustrating thing, because the mentality in the Netherlands is where there's a saying, just act normal, because that's already strange enough or crazy enough.
Right.
So when you think about outside the box too much, they're like, no, just stick with graphic design. Don't go to Hollywood. That's not possible. So for my first shot,
there's a term for that. Okay, you went to New Zealand, right?
Yes.
So isn't there a term for that in New Zealand? Like, they call it cutting poppies or something like that?
I guess so. Yeah, I've heard that before.
It's basically if the flower is too high, you cut it down.
You chop them, yeah.
So that they're all normal at the same size. And that's kind of a term. Do you think that's true in the Netherlands as well? It's like
hell yeah.
You really?
Yeah, totally. And it's still there. And that's why it became frustrating for me, because, and for my mom and my grandma as well, because they felt like I had a certain enthusiasm for things and really wanted to do this. And if school doesn't help and doesn't infuse a little bit of extra support, then you kind of put people in boxes and in corners that they, you know, they might be able to grow much more if you actually support that.
Right.
So I was very rebellious and I didn't give a shit. So what I did basically is did my visual effects, I guess, courses or studies or whatever it was, on my own, using the facilities at school, because they had good boxes. They had Macs and they had Linux and all that stuff, 3D Studio Max back then, Photoshop. So I did the classes that they required me to do to get my graphic design degree. But then in off time, I basically would make my own short movies. And the first one was obviously a Star Wars short.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. It was so awful, but, you know, got to start somewhere.
And you did this, you used your dancing to pay for that, right?
Yes, for most of it. My mom supported me, obviously, and for a lot of it.
So you got paid for dancing a lot?
Yeah,
right?
I did.
By competitions? Or
it was competitions like battles. So you basically were your group. You would go to a competition and battle to other, you know, countries within Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we got pretty good at that. But then also we did music videos or tours with the Wu-Tang Clan and Eminem. And we did all that stuff. It was really, really cool. Yeah, not wow. a lot of people know that. Dan Thrawn and people like that know that. But I kept it a secret for a very long time.
Wow.
So, because it's such a different life. Like, it's so different now. Because I basically went cold turkey with dancing when I was 24, when I moved to the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and that's, again, was all funded by most
so
of my
you're,
dancing.
So you were kind of a very successful dancer. And that was, you were using that only to pursue your real passion, which was visual effects.
Because even though I, like, dancing came, I don't want to say it came natural, but it was just kind of second nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really wanted that to carry on as like an older profession, because at a certain point, I'm 34 now, I can't see myself still having to stand on stage.
No, that's good. And it's wise of you to think that way.
And do that. And it just, the whole film, my film passion and visual effects was just so strong that I just wanted to pursue that so badly. And, it, you know, to the point where I got so frustrated, because I remember, like, Star Wars for me was what opened my eyes to visual effects.
Sure.
And then by the time Lord of the Rings came out, I remember, like, okay, I know for sure that this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I remember so clearly buying those DVDs and watching them at home and just being frustrated that those movies were already made and I was too young that I couldn't be part of that.
Right.
So, and I promised myself, like, is there ever going to do another Star Wars or another Hobbit? I'm gonna be part of that.
Right.
Yeah.
And that happened eventually.
Yeah, it did happen.
It happened eventually. Okay, so you got your design degree at that point. What was the thing that what allowed you to actually make that jump? What was the first, you know, lucky break that you got to get into visual effects?
Well, I guess at a certain point, after school, it's always like a very hard catch 22 because in order to work somewhere, you need experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in order to get experience, somebody needs to hire you. So, because I thought, let me just try first in the Netherlands, just, you know, applying at some post-production companies that do commercials. Because the Netherlands is quite successful at commercials, but it's all very, very easy visual effects work back then. And that was hard and frustrating for a while. So actually I kept dancing and I created my own theater show, which was called Age of Chaos. And that was the perfect combo for me because we did one of the first full hour breakdance theater shows that had projections on the back. So instead of we had decor or like, you know, production design, as far as like real stage elements, we projected everything on a backdrop. Like,
what year was this?
This was 2001, maybe.
Okay.
So, and I animated like a golem monster that was breakdancing. We could be in sync with him and then we would fight him. And it was really cheesy, but it was such a good, like, I just created my own work because I couldn't work anywhere.
Right.
And there was a good lesson and did my first rotomation. And I would film myself dancing and then basically imported that in Maya and did like this poor man's mocap. Right. And it was amazing because, you know, you learn so much from doing that stuff. You know,
yeah,
like, I think a lot of young people now that I see or contact me or that I run into want to go straight to, I want to work on Star Wars, I want to work on The Hobbit. But there's such a big gap in between coming from school and actually being on production.
Sure.
You know, so I always encourage everybody just to do your own projects, you know, and still today, like we all do our own projects still. We still do that.
Well, the good ones do.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I don't want to disparage it, but it's like, you know, doing your own projects is how you learn more. And that's what makes you different. If you just do the same task that someone assigns you all the time, you're not going to become different from that, right? You're not going to learn from it. And I think the whole nature of visual effects is doing something different.
Exactly.
Right? So,
and keep pushing, you know, like just don't be satisfied with what you made. You'll make the next best thing and you keep going and keep going. And you always want to have to improve because otherwise you get stuck.
Yeah.
And at a certain point from doing the theater show and everything, I put together a reel and did some smaller freelance gigs in the Netherlands for some commercial companies. And then I decided that I have enough money saved up to go to the US, just go to LA. I've never left Europe before at that point. No, that's not true. I went to Africa, but never been to the States. Mm-hmm. And I guess this was 2004. Yeah, it must have been 2004. And I went by myself 3 months to Los Angeles, never been here before, and stayed in a hostel and just basically wanted to meet people that work in the industry. And that was a very naive and crazy thing to do, but it opened my eyes. And I knocked on every single door saying, hey, I want to do visual effects. Can you guys hire me? And obviously everybody said no. So I ended up doing some simple classes at Noman.
Oh, okay.
Which was a great platform for me to meet people that were like me and were loving visual effects. And that was great. And I also volunteered a bunch of years at, because back then you had the Visual Effects Society already existed. And they did some sort of like VES festival in Frankfurt.
Okay.
So this was years ago. So I would drive, or like an uncle would drive me all the way to Frankfurt, which is like 12 hours away from Amsterdam, and like meet Dennis Muren and take a picture with him and Bill George and all these like legends in visual effects. And so I still had their email. And basically, whenever they had another VES festival in Frankfurt, I asked if I could volunteer. And so at least I could be part of it and didn't have to pay for it. So I did that a bunch of years. And then when I came to the US, it was the VES Awards, and I emailed them and saying, hey, is there any chance I could actually volunteer there too at the VES Awards? Mm-hmm. And they said, yes, come on over if you have a tux. And I did. And that's how I met George Lucas, James Cameron, John Lasseter, and all those guys, John Gaeta. And for me, it was really, really impressive to actually meet all those dudes, because finally, from, you know, watching the DVDs and looking at those making of books and remembering every name in the Cinefex, I finally met these people.
Yeah.
And they all had kind words, and they kind of encouraged me to go back to the Netherlands, work another 2 years, and just save up a lot of money again, and then try to come back together with my wife slash girlfriend back then, who also is in the industry. She does special effects. She does practical effects, and she's from the Netherlands as well.
Oh, okay.
So we came together and, again, knocked on every door, and then there was one company called Look Effects that said, sure, you know, we'll hire you and do some stuff, and that was kind of like my lucky break.
Wow. Okay. And what did you do for Look Effects?
My first movie that I did there was Pirates of the Caribbean 2, and I just did Paint Roto. It was all entry-level stuff, but I was just happy to be on a movie. I was so psyched to be on a movie. And they got me my J1 visa, which back then was like an internship visa. Mm-hmm. And that was perfect for me. But what happened is that they were quite infamous for not paying people. Mm. And after a few months, I just couldn't pay rent anymore. And I felt very failed and like, I need to go back to the Netherlands. And this is like a failed mission. And very desperately started like contacting companies again and got in touch with DD. Mm-hmm. Because to me, like another dream for me was, it's the movie Star Wars and Hobbit. But for me, the Holy Trinity back then was Weta, ILM, and DD. Mm-hmm. And to me, if I could ever work for those three companies, you know, I could get hit by a bus and I didn't care. I could, you know, I could die happily. Mm-hmm. So contacted DD and they said, oh yeah, you know, we might be able to hire you. And why don't you come all the way to SIGGRAPH and we could talk about it. And I did. And it was, I think back then it was Mike Sweeney who was doing those interviews. And he basically.
Was it SIGGRAPH in LA?
No, it was in San Diego.
Oh,
I had no money left.
Was this 2007?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was 2007.
That's the famous one, man.
I was so broke, dude, because Look Effects stopped paying me. And I was so stressed out and afraid that I'd get deported because I was still on a visa. And slept in my car in San Diego because I couldn't afford a hotel. And then finally, after waiting for hours and hours, I finally meet one of the recruiters, or I think it was Mike Sweeney at DD. And he says, yeah, I looked at your reel and come back in 3 years when you have some experience. And I was so crushed, dude.
Oh,
I was
my so God. Crushed
because I was like, you couldn't email me that? Like,
right.
But then Karen Sickles saw me walk away and she's like, hey, you want to try out for integration like Sally did as well. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, I'll do anything as long as I can work and you know, keep my visa. And I did a test, some sort of kind of like a data integration test that they would do. Mm-hmm. And I passed and that's when I started at DD, my first big gig.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You just sort of started in integration, right?
And that was and I think that was the best, you know, because if you have that foundation, data integration, and it's super, you know, solid at DD, I don't think there's any integration department in any other company that I worked at that is that solid.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, and Soam Shankar was basically leading that department and had amazing people in his department. And you always knew that if you got a camera or survey or an HDR, it would be extremely solid.
Right.
So, yeah, I basically got all that experience from there.
Well, explain to people what integration, because I don't think, you know, not everyone, you know, some people could be like you back in the Netherlands or some people, whatever. We not know what integration actually means.
Well,
like what is an integration department really?
The integration basically is the department that makes sure that everything that gets ingested and spread out into the company to be used is actually properly ingested and properly processed. So, and they're also the pool of people that go on set. So they do all the data acquisition on set.
Right.
So from reference stills to overview to photo booth material to LiDAR survey, they gather that data and then it all gets ingested and processed for people to use. And then they also do, because DD doesn't really have a layout department. It's kind of part of data integration as well. So it's one big bundle of all that, and then it gets, you know.
So let's say I'm a person, I'm going to work on a shot.
Yeah.
What I get from data integration is I get the actual plate that was used.
Yep.
I also get the track
that's
involved. This is a camera track or there's object tracking or whatever else is going on. And I also get the proper color for that. I also get all the lighting information. Mm. That's involved. I also get the complete scene rebuild, LiDAR, whatever is involved. So I can just basically plop in. And if there's layout, which is not necessarily there, that comes from, you know, previs or whatever. And then like, here's is the baseline of the animation. You may not, you know, you can, if you're an animator, Ness is where you start and you start animating properly or whatever. And then you keep going from there. And so that's a lot of information that comes from layout, right?
Yes. And a lot of responsibility as well, because it's that foundation that is so important.
Right.
Because if you want to start hacking or cheating, it's fine, but do it afterwards, you know,
sure.
Do it after the foundation is there.
Right.
And the guys in that department basically, yeah, keep it down. They hold it down. It's amazing what they do.
And you also spend a lot of times on set.
Yes. Not as much as the guys like Jesse James Chisholm and Vicky and Jeff. But yeah, I did spend a little bit of time here and there.
And so that's, you're like, okay, so now you can see the set, you know, it's like, okay, this is all the information I need to make that shot work.
Yeah.
That's a stressful job.
It's extremely stressful. And I must say, I did not enjoy it as much as I thought I would, because it sounds very glamorous. Like, oh, I want to go on set and it sounds so cool. But man, is it stressful, dude, because people yell at you and they hate you.
Yeah. I mean, it really, because, and it's insane, but you know, people that are working in production don't care that much about post-production at all.
No, they don't.
And so they give you the least amount of time.
Yep.
And so the only way that, this is something that Daniel Buck yourself, we've been on set a bunch of times for commercials, and they give us no time. It's like, do you not understand? If I don't get this information, you have no commercial.
Yeah.
Like, all you're going to have is some people on a green screen, and that's it. I need the rest of the information to make this work.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, is it? Because in the end, it's like, if we all work together, it would be the best thing, and it would be also the cheapest and most efficient. But I also feel like it must be because we are probably the last department that got created within film. I mean, film has been, you know, it's a very old art form.
Sure.
And all those, like, from the DPs to the gaffers, that has been there since the beginning. But we probably got here like 20 years, 30 years ago.
Right.
Not even.
Right.
So to those people, it's like all about tradition and union and like hierarchy. And we're the nerds on set that screw up their jobs.
It's funny because I was talking to some guys and, you know, they work on major films. And it was a friend of mine, and, you know, he works in sort of the grip department, and he had a bunch of grips that are hanging out, and I was at his house, and he was there. It's like, oh, what are you? It's like, I work in visual effects. And goes, oh yeah, you're the guys who show up with the Christmas balls. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, because they don't, what am I doing? I'm sitting there with a camera shooting a bunch of pictures randomly in the sky, which is the HDR.
Yep.
I'm doing some kind of a measurement of distance. I'm like, it's like, oh my God, can we just keep going? Do the next shot. Because they don't understand that this is like all critical information that needs to happen. Yeah, integration's tough.
Yep.
It's a real tough thing. I think it's gotten better.
Yep.
I think in terms of the way that they understand it, I think they've gotten better. I think that DPs certainly have gotten smarter to it because they have to be involved in it now in pre-production. Right?
Yeah.
So pre-production day is like, okay, the only way this shot's going to work is if that happens. And now I've already been informed of what has to happen in pre-production. So by the time I'm shooting, I'm aware of what needs to happen after that. And I think, well, the biggest thing I always tell people is if you're going to be on set at all for visual effects, the number one person you have to be friends with is the AD.
Yep.
The assistant director holds.
Give him a case of beer or whatever, he or she, because that's the person that will get you the stuff that you would need.
Right. Time.
Yeah.
Time is more specifically. Yep. They hold the stopwatch of how long it takes for you to do anything. Because time, every second counts, is like imagine a taxi cab with that meter running at full speed. And if it takes too long, then they're going to be really pissed off.
They'll cut you off. Yep.
Yep. So it's an interesting thing, integration. I think it's a fascinating field, and when it works really well, it works really, really well.
Yeah.
So you were involved in integration for a while, and you did some fantastic work in that area.
Yeah, I thought that I'd never wanted to be in that department for too long because it never sounded very glamorous. You always want to be making the images instead of providing people the actual foundation. But I think my first thing that I really got into it as far as data integration goes was The Mummy 3.
Oh, right.
And you were at DD at that point too,
right? I left on Mummy 3. That was another Rob Cohen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was Joel Hynek and Matthew Butler and then...
Same group, yeah.
And then Jeffrey Bauman, who's now a VFX soup at Marvel, who's one of, like, I always call him my VFX cousin because, you know, he took me in.
Oh, he's awesome.
He took me under his wing and
he's a very important person. Yeah, he's such a nice guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's wonderful. He... was my lead. Mm-hmm. And he basically saw that I had a certain skill set that wasn't just, you know, one particular thing. Because in the Netherlands, again, there is no room for a specialist. You have to be kind of like a jack of all trades because the industry was so small and the gigs that you do and kind of like a generalist, which is much more accepted nowadays, I think, than
I think it used to be. Yeah, I think so. I think there's generalist is not an evil word as it used to be. Yeah, it used to be kind of like generalist, exactly. Do some crappy commercials or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so because Jeff and actually Lou Pecora as well saw that I was very interested in learning Nuke. And what I would do is I would be the first person that got at DD in the morning and then was the last person to leave. Mm-hmm. And I would, for example, Aruna Inverson, one of the, you know, super compers, I would bug him and be like, hey, can I make a copy of your script and just plow through it? And he was so, you know, so nice and gentle to say, like, listen, if you want me to run you through the script, I can teach you a couple of things. And so I basically taught myself Nuke on The Mummy. Mm-hmm. And there was a scene with Jet Li where he was bleeding some mud and stuff, and they couldn't quite figure out the tracking. So I kind of built one of the first facial projection rigs in Nuke.
Oh, wow.
And just by accident and kind of like figuring out, like, how can we do this and how can we control this in 2D in UV space versus, you know, trying to do it all in 3D. Mm-hmm. And Lou Pecora noticed that and got me in touch with the Foundry, and that became a whole thing because at that point, the Foundry just bought Nuke.
Right.
And they kind of wanted to convince the industry that, you know, it's not going to be just a DD product, but it's going to be a product for all. Mm-hmm. So right after The Mummy, what happened is that my visa was up. And I needed to go back to the Netherlands for a while until my visa was renewed. And the Foundry jumped on that and said, listen, why don't we do a little Europe tour with your Mummy thing and basically go everywhere. And it was amazing, man. Because nice. I was like, this was like a dream. Like, really? I was going to Madrid and London and spend time with the Foundry, and they recorded it. And then it became a video and effects guide, which was like a website I adored. Mm-hmm. And it became like this little, you know, Nuke fame thing, which was amazing.
That's amazing.
And that basically led me to go into the environments department at DD, which was the thing that I really wanted to do.
Okay, so what do you mean by environments department? Explain that one a little bit.
Well, that's funny because we didn't really have an environments department.
No, we did. But it's an important thing. So explain that a little bit.
So the environments department more or less was a group of people that had that data integration background and took cameras and all the HDRs and basically recreated sets.
Okay.
And basically do a digital version of the set, so a digital set. And we took it a step further because instead of just doing that, we wanted to create CG environments that just didn't exist, but we didn't have that strong CG background as a department because mm-hmm. we came from data integration. So it was mostly based on creating a Nuke environments department, I guess, with mm-hmm. a lot of projections. And that's how I got to meet Dan Thrawn because he was a matte painter back at DD. Mm-hmm. And that's how we basically created a lot of the environments in G.I. Joe, for example, which were all projections and paintings.
Projections, right. I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing because I don't think a lot of people sort of know, like, that is actually what a lot of matte painting has become mm-hmm. now, right? Dan Thrawn is almost more of a traditional matte painter in the sense of, like, he just goes into Photoshop and does things, right? And then he relies on people that have, you know, a little bit more projection 3D skills to do the projection, et cetera. But that's really what it is. Yep. It's about taking your environments and projecting them onto real geometry that can exist in 3D in Nuke. And a lot of people don't necessarily – it took a while for people to think of Nuke as a full-on 3D package in some way. And I think that, you know, that's now like almost – the best place to do your environments in a lot of ways. It's like if you're doing background environments, you don't always need to build it all from scratch. Render it and shade it. You can actually project it based on paintings, right?
No, totally. And that was just a very cool thing because that's how I got to meet Dan Thrawn. I was like, and I wasn't a very strong painter. And then I saw him paint and was like, holy shit, man.
Yeah, he can paint.
Fucking amazing, man.
He can paint.
He's a machine. Yeah. So we actually became we had a good partnership going because whatever, you know, we needed as far as matte painting, he would give to me. I would build his projections and give him passes, like wireframe passes. And we just cranked out some crazy shit, just him and me. And that was really, really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I did that with him a little bit on the CG side, not so much in the Nuke side, but basically I would say, all right, I've got this much rendered. Yep. Can you fill in the rest? and then he would just like bang it out. It looked amazing. And it's like, all right, I don't have to render the rest of that. It's all painted by Dan. So
yeah, and I think you guys kind of, because I think at a certain point we were we on Real Steel together. Were you on Real Steel?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Real Steel for me was the best show at DD has ever been on. That was a dream with Eric Nash and all those guys. It was just so awesome.
Yeah,
and we kind of built a little bit of a reprojection pipeline where we would bake out a lot of our CG because we had those stadiums in Real Steel that we needed to build, and then together with Sally and Laura Lee, we baked all that stuff out, reprojected it, painted it, because I wasn't very good at doing full CG environments yet. Like, I just wasn't trained that way. Mm-hmm. So I relied heavily on people like Dan Thron to just improve that CG. But instead of having it being a screen space projection, we wanted it to kind of be like giving the compositors the freedom to still use AOVs. Mm-hmm. So we only paint inside the diffuse color channel versus it being all baked in.
Right.
So, and I think, you carried that on as well in, what was that, 47 Ronin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the thing is, It's hard to a lot of painters or matte painters want to paint with light and shadow, right?
Yep.
They want an
atmosphere.
An atmosphere and everything else. And basically, in order for it to work in 3D and for changing in lighting, you have to paint full flat lighting.
Yep.
Right? So all the lighting is flat, and then you project that, and then you light it.
Yep.
In whatever you're going to be using to render, or even Nuke, you can do it in Nuke as well. But that just basically do it that way, and that's a great tool. The first time I did that was with was it John Green.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And it was on Tron.
Yep.
And he and I were working on a big scene for one of the. It's in the trailer. You just, when the rectifier first comes out and he's flying up and flies past camera left to right. And you see the whole city there, and it's like, it's a massive amount. It's like
it's huge.
Huge city and all this stuff. And in order for it to actually, to build all of that and render it would have been horrible. Right. Yeah. So what we did, we had rough geometry and he would basically paint. But he would paint the maps I needed to render.
Yep.
So he would paint a diffuse map, and then it was – the diffuse was actually properly lit, but it was diffuse. There was no specular on it. And then he would paint the – what would amount to a specular map.
Yep.
And I would only render the specular so that the specular light would change as the camera moved, and then everything kind of worked. So it was a projected specular map. Yep.
Well, and that's the cool thing too, is because you're utilizing very talented map painters, and the skill set of a map painter is an environment. That's what they do.
Right.
And a texture artist doesn't necessarily have an affinity just with environments. Could be creatures, could be vehicles. So you're utilizing somebody that does environments,
right?
But using kind of their map paint / texture skills through screen space and making sure that it's optimal for what you're seeing.
Yeah, exactly.
It being all asset based, which sometimes you're like, you can spend weeks on an asset and then you put it in a shot. You're like, God damn it. It just doesn't look as I thought it would look.
Yeah, because you're using like 1/10 of the pixels exactly, that you painted, right? So it's an interesting idea of how map painting actually works and how, especially now in modern times, and it's like a lot of it is really great in projection because you can actually see that that's kind of what it's going to look like. It's going to get better and better through comping and lighting. But you already have an idea of visually how that's going to fit together, right? And so Nuke became your big tool at that point, right?
Yeah. I just kept building on it and just because I had a little bit of Maya skills as well, and I would use whatever maps I could generate from that and go from there and did, I believe, A-Team and Real Steel and Iron Man like that as well. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing because the cool thing was at DD back then was that they gave me like the freedom and they trusted me in order to do what I wanted to do.
Sure.
And that's very unique because I don't think you see that much anymore in any company. And they basically, like, I feel like DD wasn't just, and some people that haven't worked at DD, as hate that I always bring DD up because, but it's really, it's a warm blanket for me, man.
Sure.
It's like DD is my family and I started working at DD when I was 23. And even though when you're 23, you think you're an adult, I wasn't. I really wasn't.
Nope.
And as inexperienced I was as far as you know, the industry went, I was also inexperienced as a human being, and mm-hmm. you get raced through all the people around you, and so right. that was a really, really amazing experience for me, and I still look back like, you know, with a great smile.
Well, I want to go back to some of the Real Steel stuff, because you and I worked on that obviously, but I think there was some really interesting things that we did in combination with de-integration and matte painting team and lighting all together on Real Steel, specifically on a lot of those big stadium things, right? Yeah. Those stadiums are kind of special, right? They're like, from my point of view, right? Yeah. Just as I was put on Real Steel as a quote unquote lighter. I wasn't given any of the supervisor roles because I was kind of between that was already well started, and they basically said, just go on Real Steel as a lighter and then you can get to the next one. I was like, great, no problem. And it was cool. It was so interesting because from my point of view, I said, wow, look at this. I'm lighting the robots and they're doing their fight, and the integration was unbelievably good. Yeah. So like I could just – I was given, I think, like 28 shots to light, and I pretty much lit them all in one quarter of the time that they asked me to, because it's already done for me. Like integration, I had everything figured out. And all of the stadium was all reprojected, all the crowds, everything was just put in. And I've seen the movie a bunch of times recently because suddenly my kids picked up on it.
Yeah.
And they love it. Like it's like, I love Real Steel. And I was like, wow, you cannot tell
that
CG background, CG stadiums. And it's all done through matte paintings and projections and all those things.
It's all Nuke. Yeah. It was all basically funneled through Nuke. And the reason for that too was that, and I've learned that now that I'm not at DD anymore, that I had to kind of, you know, bump up my CG skills because not every single house is a compositing house. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we always wanted to funnel through Nuke was because DD was just a very strong comp house.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt like if I have those people on my side, whatever I create will only get better if it gets into their hands.
Right.
So I wanted to give them the freedom. And I remember very clearly after, I think Percy Jackson, Sven Gilbert came up to me and he's like, hey, dude, we're going to make you environments lead. And we have this big problem with crowds and shit. Mm-hmm. And figure it out. I was like, holy crap. So I needed to figure out this crowd system and came up with a system together with Sally Slade of how to shoot the people and how we could, you know, easily swap out clothing so we have more people and how we could relight them and build a big system around it. And that was all Nuke. And back then, Nuke can only render like or have 1,024 objects. So Laura Lee and Sally had to build this whole,
I think it was
like,
1,024 layers, I think it was.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, also like
let me tell
objects.
You about how old I am. Back when I was at DD, before it was a public product, there was only 16 channels God that it damn. Could support, I think. Or maybe, no, it was 64, which is way too low.
Yep.
And then I was like, oh, 64 channels. We'll never use all of these. And then I think I went to Sony and they were still using Banzai at the time. And they had four. They had RGBA. And if you went to do anything, you had to pretty much just swap out alpha for anything. It was horrible. And then I remember it's like, well, Nuke is now 1,024 channels. Which seems like ridiculous, and that still wasn't enough.
And Sally built this whole system around it where it was like pre-comping it out and shuffling it back in automatically and based on layers and based on depth. It would all sort that stuff out, and it was pretty fun because we did it in a way where, you know, you could traditionally shoot crowds on cards and be like, okay, we have a dude that cheers, we have a dude that sits.
Right.
But I kind of said, and that, I guess this goes back to the whole dance experience. Like, I think instead of, you know, cutting it up in actions, do one continuous action. So you have 4 seconds of sitting, 4 seconds of cheering. And because you know exactly at what time they stand up and cheer, you have a slider and you can say, like, at this moment, I want everybody to get up and cheer. Mm-hmm. And because people naturally have that randomness of not getting up at the same time,
right,
you get that really natural transition because otherwise you get pops.
And this was done in compositing.
Yes.
Not done in Massive or something like
that. No, because it was very clearly that the execs from DreamWorks hated Massive. Oh, so Sven came up to me, he's like, whatever you do, never mention Massive because they hate it. So we came. And the funny thing was too is that—
So you just had videos of people doing this and you were just swapping it out.
We did back then. I think we didn't have the stage screening room yet. It was still like a stage, so we would go out there and shoot. And Jeff and I basically did a bunch of tests to see if the system would work, and did a proof of concept and ran it through the stadium, and it actually worked. So
yeah,
I basically made a whole, and that is the data integration side for me again. Made a whole documentation for Jeff and Sven how to shoot these people on set, so we get the data back and ingest it and built the whole system around it with Sally.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, it was a really cool system. I don't know if this was part of, I don't think it was part of you guys. Well, it's definitely part of the integration, but there was also another really cool thing that they did, which was for lighters, is that there, you know, we would do the primary lighting, but because it was a stadium, there was a ton of flash photography going on.
Yes.
And we would have a pass, which was just the easiest thing possible for lighter. It was just basically a pass where it was the robots were lit with every possible direction of flash.
Yeah, so you could basically turn it on and off.
And in comp, they would just basically go in and it's like, oh, does a flash click? Yep. Turn that on, click.
Yeah.
And basically the flash, they would just time, they would see from the plate there's a flash, and they would figure out approximately what direction it was coming from, and they would just turn that on in the render element of the robot, and it would just all just timed itself out perfectly. To the lighter, it was like, great, I don't have to worry about that, you know.
Yeah, and it was really cool. Basically, you have everything on, and basically the compositor can choose and kind of really finesse that.
Can pick which one does what. Yeah,
just super smart and efficient.
Yeah, it was a really, really great system. All right, so what happened after all that? DD for a long time.
Yeah, I think I was a DD for 7 years and had a blast. But after a certain point with the whole bankruptcy that was going on, I felt like I needed to spread my wings and just do something else. Because I was just afraid if I get stuck at DD, I might be doing the same thing and just... You know, I just wanted to evolve, like I said before. Like, you know, I wanted to keep growing, and I still had a wish of working for Weta one day and maybe be part of the Hobbit trilogy. So, a friend of mine actually got me an interview at Weta.
Right.
And but they only needed compositors, and I didn't see myself as a compositor, because that's the thing, though. It's like, you can use Photoshop, but that doesn't mean you're a matte painter. And
sure,
even if you use Nuke, that doesn't mean you're a compositor, and especially the respect I have for compositors at DD, I felt it was blasphemy to call myself a compositor.
Sure.
Even though I did some of it, I just was too afraid to call myself that. So Charlie Tate, who was the head of the department at Weta for comp, called me anyways and said, listen, you're from DD. We've seen your mummy video with the mud. We know there's a lot of people here that vouch for you, and I think you could comp easily at Weta.
And he
basically convinced me to go over there, and I spent some time in New Zealand working on the second and third Hobbit, which was amazing.
Really?
Yeah, it was great. It was. I mean, New Zealand in general is beautiful, and it's Middle Earth. So if you're a Lord of the Rings nerd, you would love it there. And got to meet a lot of great people, and it was great too, because like London is very close to Amsterdam. It's only a half an hour flight. And
right.
London has a visual effects industry, but for some weird reason, I don't quite know why, I just skipped that. I went straight to the US.
Right.
And then, so my whole visual effects experience and friends too are all American, or came through the American system as far as visual effects goes. And now being at Weta, I saw this whole other side of like Danish and Germans and you know, and Australians. So it was a really cool way of like meeting all these new people I just never met before. And
right.
So it was a really cool eye opener.
How long were you at Weta?
So the first time I was there for a year, and then I left because years ago I entered. This is funny because I have visas, right? Because I'm not an American citizen. I'm Dutch. I entered the green card lottery because somebody told me, like, hey, you can enter an actual green card lottery, and if you win, you get it. And people have entered for years and years, and some people have actually won it. So my wife and I entered the first year, and we won.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we won the green card, man. It's crazy. So it was meant to be. And but because of that green card, you at least need to enter the U.S. once. So after a year, I needed to go back and work a little bit in the U.S. And and I got the opportunity to work at ILM, which was crazy.
What were you doing at ILM?
At ILM, I would be comping as well, which still felt really strange to me because I still didn't feel like a compositor, but that's what they hired me for on Turtles. And what happened is that on G.I. Joe, I worked with a bunch of ex-ILM guys that DD externally hired to work internally because we couldn't do all the environments. So they hired a bunch of guys from Whiskey Tree
from
the Bay Area. But those are a bunch of ex-ILM guys. And I became friends with them and stayed in touch with them. And then by the time I got to ILM to work on Turtles, they saw me in the hallway and like, what the hell are you doing here? It's like, oh, man, you guys are back at ILM. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. was like, I'm compositing. And then the first thing he said, no, you are not compositing. You're coming to the environments department with us.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So they basically stole me. And I think it's kind of like they call Digimat or generalist now. It's a different department.
Yeah. I think they call it the generalist department. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind of those are funky name because it's basically more like a 3D Studio Max group, I guess.
Yeah, I know exactly who those guys. I know a lot of who's the Swedish guy who does a lot of work there. Oh my God, what's his name?
Johan.
Yes, thank you. Yeah,
and I got a great pool of people working there. And to be fair, like, I really wanted to work in that department. That to me was the holy grail of environments.
They're great,
but I was so afraid, dude. Like, I felt like I wasn't good enough. So they basically pulled me in and we started, they started training me and getting me up to speed at 3D Studio Max. And, I've always heard about this guy that they, you know, his name was Susumu Yukihiro. He's kind of like a Japanese environments master.
Right.
And back in the DD days, they were already talking, about him and I got to work with him and became friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an amazing experience. And funny enough, I'm not sure if you know Mike Arala, compositor that worked at DD as well. Who I was working with at ILM, as a joke, mentions to production on Turtles, oh, guys, Justin is a dancer. You should ask him to dance. And instead of them making fun of me, they're like, oh, really? You're a dancer? We actually need somebody to mocap all the dance scenes in Turtles.
Oh, my God, really?
So I got to play Michelangelo for a lot of mocap stuff on the Turtles movie.
Oh, my God.
So it's like it's a crazy full circle how the dancing stuff kind of came back again. And That was amazing because it was just supposed to be a day of dance mocap, I guess, because there's a dance scene.
Mm-hmm.
But they were like, oh, well, you're suited up and you kind of, you have a good like body language going on. Why don't you just stay for another week and a half and do like other scenes as well?
Wow.
So I basically was.
You became a mocap artist.
I became a mocap artist, dude. Right. Like Andy Serkis, man. Watch out, dude.
Wow. That's amazing. That was happening at ILM.
Yeah. And it's like, if you think about it, like you end up at ILM, you composite, then you go to the environments department. And then while you're doing that, you're also doing a little bit of mocap on the side.
But not as a mocap artist, but as an actual performer.
Mocap performer, yeah. And it was so cool, dude, because, it's one of those things that is so different from sitting behind the box.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot of fun. And that led to all these other mocap things within ILM for like the Star Tours ride and another Pirates of the Caribbean ride and another pitch for the second Turtles movie. So I was kind of on their list of like, oh, we got like an internal mocap performer, dude.
Right.
So they would call me up and I would just, be on the stage for a while and do that stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really
so
cool.
So what did you work on at ILM? So, besides the Turtles? Obviously.
Well, Turtles. And then after that, because ILM asked me to stay, but I really wanted to go back to Weta because the thing was, what was cool about Weta is that my wife, who's in the industry as well, she does practical effects.
Okay.
So we wanted to go back to Weta again so she could work for the Weta workshop and I could work for Weta Digital.
Gotcha.
Just like the double whammy. And yep. It's amazing. So we went back for the third Hobbit movie and she got to work at the Weta workshop as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was amazing. But then that same supervisor, Susumu Yukihiro, said, well, what if I do Star Wars as a soup? Would you come back and work for me?
Nice.
And I was like, holy shit! If that happens, I'll go bananas.
So here you go. You got two Hobbit spine.
Yep.
And then you're going back to ILM.
Yep.
To work on Star Wars. this is obviously for
The Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I was initially, we got the conversation going, and it was a bit of a political thing too, because I guess, everybody wants to work on Star Wars and there's so many talented people at ILM that are aligned to work on Star Wars, but he really wanted to work with me because we share a similar mentality as far as work ethic.
Okay.
So he really fought hard for me to get on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, I was initially just supposed to be an environments artist, but he knew that I was a lead before and a soup before. So he gave me the, I think sequence soup is what they call it. Environment mm-hmm. sequence soup role on the Jakku sequence.
Yeah, which is the when the Millennium Falcon is flying through everything, right? That's a big sequence. Pinnacle thing, right?
We initially thought that it was a smaller thing. That's why I guess they kind of trusted me with it, but it became a very big thing. I think that's the craziest thing I've ever done in my life. That was such a weird emotional experience from being very excited to feeling not good enough to do this, like I wasn't worthy. And working with all this talent like Roger Guyette and then Dennis Muren would just pop in and give comments and Yannick Dussault, which is a guy that I adored since I was a teenager. I got to meet him and got to work directly with him, who is basically one of those old school matte painters that did all the matte paintings on the prequels, but now became an art director. So I worked directly on with him on that Jakku sequence. And then the great thing was, too, is that I always used to work with a guy named Mike Wood, and I actually stole him from Method to come to ILM, and he had the opportunity to come into my team for that sequence as well. So it was just great because I was just doing Star Wars with one of the coolest sequences in those movies with friends, which is just amazing.
I mean, that, and so what was the process of doing that? Was it the same techniques you've been using, a lot of projections? And
no, not at all. This was, for me...
This is much more generalist idea.
Yeah, it was much more generalist idea. And the thing was, too, is that because of the motion and the speed, we did shoot plates.
Right.
But we kind of needed to go the CG route. So I wasn't, as I told before, as strong with CG as I was with matte painting and projections. But I just taught myself, you know, how to do that. And with the help from Susumu and from Mike, got up to speed. But then Susumu was really interested in this new software called Clarice.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And that was a big, like, kind of blasphemous thing to say because, you know, initially the generalist department is a 3D Studio Max department. So we wanted to try it on that sequence, and we did. And I got to learn Clarice, and we kept, basically the pipeline was that we would get great concept art from Yannick Dussault. We would basically model our stuff and pipe it all through Clarice, which is just a geometry beast because it doesn't matter what you throw at it, it just eats it.
Right.
And that was great because we were doing all this crazy dune displacements that we had like elevation maps of and sculpted in the ZBrush. And usually what you would do is you get a displacement map and do it the efficient way, but it didn't matter. We could just put billions and billions of polys into Clarice and play with that and kind of shot sculpt it to where it looked amazing. And then still we would actually use matte painting to kind of put the finishing touches on it.
Sure.
And then Susumu would say, we call that, you need to make it tasty.
Tasty. Nice.
You know, so the CG looks okay, but now let's make it tasty by just adding a little bit of that extra little paint quality to it. So
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like I said, it's a very memorable thing. And I kind of know what you mean when you're suddenly sort of incidentally put into what may become like a pinnacle thing, right? Because I remember when that happened to me on Tron, I was kind of supposed to help out with environment lighting on Tron. And then as things were progressing and they were having a little bit of, they decided they were going to start doing the light bike sequence in V-Ray, and they were having a little bit of problem getting the light bikes to look right, just little physical light bikes, the bikes themselves. And Eric Barbo was telling me, I was like, well, you know, Chris has got a lot of car commercial experience in V-Ray, like tell him what to do. And so I was, and basically the light bike is like a really fancy car, right? Yeah. So I was helping on that. And then suddenly out of nowhere, I'm like, well, you're the lighting lead on the light bike sequence. And I was like, wait a minute, that's like a major sequence in this movie. And it's like, that's like the pinnacle thing. This is what they used to actually get the movie greenlit.
And so I
think it just happens naturally, right? Yeah. And that's usually the best way, as opposed to like, I'm gonna be blah blah blah. You know, it's like just like, no, you're here because we need you, and that's when it's gonna help. So it's kind of nice, and that sequence is fantastic. I mean, it's amazing, and I don't know how the hell you guys came up with all those. It must have been amazing previs to get all the motion right and all that stuff. But it's a great sequence, and I think it's. Narratively, it's kind of interesting too because it's a little bit clunky. You know, they don't quite know how to fly the Millennium Falcon, and they're doing this stuff, and it goes through an incredible environment. So it was really, really cool. Although I do have a question for you,
sure,
because this kind of bothered me when I saw the movie. I saw the movie several times.
Yeah,
the first time I saw it in 2D. And the second time I saw it in 3D, and I way liked it better in 2D.
Yeah, me too.
You too?
Yeah.
And this is my reason why, is that in 2D, it felt huge.
Yeah.
And I think they made the interocular too big.
Yep, they did.
So that it—
They pushed it too far.
They pushed it too far where everything looked like a miniature.
Yep. And that, and a lot of people thought that was intentional, like, oh, cool, they're going for the miniature route. But it's like, no. Because that's the thing that was the hardest about that sequence, like conveying skill. Right. Because these ships are huge. They are massive. And it was just a very, very extremely crazy task to make sure that we got the skill right.
Right.
But not necessarily skill as far as like, okay, this ship is 1.6 miles long and we make it 1.6 miles long. No, it needed to feel like this is just a giant, like a big, massive ruin.
Right.
And that was the hardest thing to do. It was just, that was very, very difficult. And I felt like as soon as they did the whole stereo process, like, oh, it kind of ruined it in some places.
And that was done in post, right?
Yeah, it was. This was not a stereo, native stereo show.
Right, so it was done as a
conversion job.
Conversion job, which is, it's a shame to me because I think people, there's this feeling like you got to give them depth or they feel like they're ripped off of their stereo. It was like, but you just ruined the whole look of that thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Do.
Especially large environments. These are things that don't have as much depth, right?
They just don't because it's so far away, it actually flattens out.
Right. I mean, the best thing you can do, you know, is to treat the frame like a window and just make things very deep.
Yes.
Right. And not necessarily have a lot of interdepth because then to do that, I think. Anyway, it was just a little pet peeve of mine about the sequence, like, because I felt that that sequence got a little bit shortchanged by the stereo.
Yeah, and I agree. And if you know, thank God they put out the 2D version as well, so we can see it in the 2D version. Because the first time I saw it was 2D. Mm. Oh no, but I think the trailer was already converted as well.
Mm.
And the bigger shot that I did, which is the easiest shot I've done on the whole sequence, which is basically just a massive map painting, is the Crash Star Destroyer shot.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they basically almost ruined that in stereo.
Yeah, yeah. It's the one where she's rolling down the hill?
No, it's the one where you see very tiny speeder and it's this massive Crash Star
Destroyer. Oh, right.
Basically, the trailer started like that, and which is crazy too because initially that was just a simple shot that was the third or fourth shot in the teaser trailer. But then JJ loved it so much that he basically opened the trailer with that.
Right.
Which again, and that. There's one thing to do visual effects and you're executing the wishes of a director, but then doing a Star Wars movie, there's this extra pressure of like making sure that you do not piss off a certain fan or whoever because you're so, you know, it's such an emotional thing. You want to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
So all the research that we've done from going to the Lucasfilm archives and making sure that the language is correct and that the skill is right and that we basically built on the whole Ralph McQuarrie style of even destroying things, that it all looked correct.
Right.
And that was just crazy. I still can't believe I did that. That's still one of my, you know, myself every day.
Yeah. I mean, you remember just going back to where we started this, where you were sitting in your grandmother's house watching Star Wars, and now suddenly you're working on the biggest sequence of one of the of the episodes, which is great, which is absolutely wonderful. All right, so where have you gone from since then? What's the next things that have happened to you?
So after Star Wars, my wife wanted to go back to Weta again.
Really?
She got a job offer to work on...
What does she do in practical effects?
She basically does props, costumes, and special effects makeup. So she kind of bounces around. So, and with costumes, it's not like traditional costumes, but it's specialty costumes. Actually, she built the Tron suit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so she did, like, with the team, she built, like, the LEDs and stuff.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
And unfortunately, sometimes that stuff didn't work, but it was really groundbreaking because nobody's done that before.
Yeah, and I think I really am disappointed that was not nominated for costume at Oscars because I think that was BS. I think that was because, there's two things. I think soundtrack should have been nominated, and I think costume should have been nominated because they just – especially in the costume department, they just want to give it to all the period pieces.
It's always the same thing. It's always the period pieces. But I also think it's just education. I don't think people realize that how much time is spent and that's actually a real suit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The same thing with the whole Benjamin Button things, like makeup effects got nominated for or won the best makeup award because they thought most of those shots were makeup.
Right. And they, in fact, even in the reel, they were using the CG to show off makeup.
I remember that.
That's so embarrassing.
It is. Right. And it's hard too because kind of like in the industry, my wife and I are not supposed to be together because we are the devils in the makeup effects and special effects world.
Right.
And it works out. It works out nicely because even though we work in the same industry and we do kind of the same thing, we do not have the same problems. So when we come home, we can complain about different stuff, which really helps.
Well, that's cool. So, okay. So do you go back to what then?
Yeah. So we basically, she got a gig on Ghost in the Shell, which was shooting in New Zealand locally. And then she would do that for Weta Workshop.
Okay.
And I just basically followed her because after me doing Star Wars and being away from LA for another year, because I was living in San Francisco and she was basically going back and forth because she was doing a project at Weta still while I was in San Francisco. And then she had a bunch of smaller projects in LA. She did Batman vs. Superman and the X-Men movies. So I basically said, like, listen, I've done what I wanted to do. All I want to do now is be with you or wherever you want to go. And she said, sure. Well, let's go back to Weta. And I did BFG and Independence Day there.
Oh, okay.
And came back this summer and then started at Method, which is my first job in LA in 4 years.
Wow.
Because after Iron Man 3, I left and basically bounced back and forth between SF and Island because I went back and forth like three, four times.
Yeah. That's a funny year, Method, because I was literally at Method a couple of hours ago. I you know, for those who are listening, I just recorded the podcast with Ed Albrecht.
Of course.
It's funny. Yeah,
Method. She made me drive all the way up here when you were there. No kidding.
Yeah, it's like, Ed, can you get out of your office? I'm going to interview Justin.
Exactly.
So, no, who's but that? Method is interesting because I was talking about it with Ed, and it's like, it's probably now the biggest visual effects house in Los Angeles.
It is.
And
it
if
is.
Not, you know, one of the major, major players in visual effects worldwide, but certainly in LA, there's nothing bigger than
and
Method.
And it absorbed so many good talent, like all the people that basically left DD or R&H. Like, there's so much good people there. And then that was the big reason why I wanted to try it out, because Blake Sweeney is there and Nordine is there and all those ex-DDers are there, which, you know, again, is family to me.
They're good guys. They're good guys. Method is interesting. They're doing a lot of amazing work. And obviously the caliber of work that's going there is exponentially grown. Specifically, they've gotten all the right kind of talent. People like you and Blake and all those guys are doing really great work. And so how long have you been at Method now?
I started this summer, so it's like July. So I think it's like 6-7 months now.
Okay. Yeah, are you under contract? Or are you working as a...
It's currently freelance because the reason why I wanted to come back to LA was because my wife got pregnant in New Zealand and we wanted to have an American baby because, you know...
Sure.
Because two Dutchies, need to have an American baby.
That's right.
But, it's basically currently just a freelance gig.
Right.
And then we'll see what happens. I really don't know, like... It's been such an amazing 3.5 years after, you know, when I left DD. I never expected that this all would happen.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know, because I kind of like being in the same place for a while. Like, I like my place, my home.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought that I would be that person that would travel that much, but I'm really
enjoying it. You are traveling a lot.
Yeah. Though. And you know, now that the baby's still young, I might still, you know, use that, you know, because you don't really have to be in one place yet.
Yeah. So by the time 4 or 5 years from now, you're going to start saying, oh, shit. Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. Welcome to my world. That's kind of why I left, because I just couldn't do it. You know, I can't take, you know, a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old and say, yeah, by the way, we're going to move like a military family.
Yeah.
I can't do that.
No, that's tough.
Yeah. So it became the right choice for me. In fact, it was a really great choice when I came to Chaos Group. I just didn't realize how good it was going to be. But it really allowed me to sort of explore a lot of different ways that I can communicate with people. The podcast is one of them, which has been amazing. And you said you listened to the podcast, right?
Yeah, man. Like, my friend from Weta, actually, Sangeeta, got me onto it. She's like, hey, dude, like, you should listen to this the CG Garage, and it has a lot of mates from DD on it. And it's like, what? And then the first one I listened to was with Dan Thrawn, and I just laughed my ass off because it's so funny. And yeah, it's great, dude. Like, I got into podcasts when I was working at Weta and basically wanted to...
Is it a good work thing? Is
it's brilliant because the thing is, like, you know, watching a documentary or, you know, quote unquote, listening to a documentary or music sometimes takes me out of it. But if it's, you know, people talking, it's just interesting enough and background enough.
Yeah. I try to make it conversational, like you're overhearing a conversation.
That's what I really like about it. It's not like an interview of like you're going through your list of questions. No, it's actual conversation.
Right.
And it's so many different interesting people that work in this industry that, like you said, might not be a supervisor or just an artist. And it's just these stories are just really cool to hear.
Yeah, my goal is, you know, obviously I've had a lot of very well-renowned people on the podcast, but that's not necessarily my goal. My goal is really to find interesting people and interesting stories. And I think, you know, you've got a fantastic story.
Well, that's why I asked you. He's like, why do you want me on your podcast, dude? Yeah. Like,
no. It's yeah, it's great stories. And I think a lot of people will do that. It's just, you've taken a lot. This one thing that I would say what people could take from this is you've taken a lot of risks, right? Yep. You basically said, sure, I'll do that. Sure, yep. I'll try that. And some people are scared to take those risks.
Yep.
And they just need to be able to do that. And I've heard this from all levels of people. And you know, I did a podcast with Art Gensler, who's the head of the largest or founder of the largest architecture firm in the world called Gensler Architects or Gensler. And he was basically saying, is like, you know, take risks. That's one thing that he's good at. It's like, this sounds like something maybe we can do. Let's just try it. And that's what you did. It's like,
no, totally.
I could probably do that. You know, you slept in your car at SIGGRAPH in 2007 just to say, yeah, I'll take that risk.
Yep. Well, and it's the thing is too, like when you're younger, that's a little bit easier, I guess, because I literally had like, I have nothing to lose. Because what do I have to lose? Like the worst thing that can happen is that, well, you know, my visa doesn't get extended and I have to go back to the Netherlands and I have family there. So,
right.
But yeah, you have to take a leap of faith and you have to really, you know, realize like how much you want this, because this is not a normal job and this is not a normal industry.
Mm-mm.
And it's so up and down and it's a really strange job that we're in. So you got to really fucking love it.
The result is amazing.
Yes.
But the journey there is hard and tedious.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It really, really is.
Yeah.
But to me, it's worth it. You know, like I've met so many people and I think that's basically the wealth that I have is that I have such a wonderful group of friends all over the world now. And that's all because of visual effects. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been awesome talking to you. I'm glad you're back in town and we can make this happen. And I've wanted to talk to you for a while about it because I think you've always been a fun and entertaining and very, very positive person. Yes, every time I've talked to you, you've always been like, "Yeah, that sounds great. Let's do something fun and cool." And you've thought of some great ideas. So I really appreciate it you being on here.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks so much, Nate.
All right, thank you.